Good evening, you guys. K2 Romeo India Whiskey here. My name is Dick. This time we begin the TechNet on Landmark. We'll also hear John, KC2WGB, who tracks the internet. Here we go. Tracks the Echo Link. Whether or not anybody has any trouble getting in that way or wants to give us a message. You'll also hear Wes. Here we go. You'll also hear Paul, WS2N, who tells us what NASA is doing. And then you'll also hear from time to time Hal, K6TPZ, who has a lot of experience with ham radio equipment. That group of four guys tries to create this educational experience that takes place in New York City. And for those people who connect from much further out areas, they're included. This particular repeater has a lot of coverage of the tri-state area of New York City. Let me drop it. Which means northern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, much of Long Island. In fact, almost all of Long Island by way of the two repeaters that are connected together on Long Island. This one on 146.85 and the eastern one on 147.375. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. On almost all TechNets, let me drop. On almost all of them, the majority of the subjects discussed are the ones that you guys bring as questions. Tonight's a little bit of an exception. After the normal first hour question and answer period, there will be a little bit of a lecture, so to speak, that has been planned because Kay wrote a very nice question, a very simple sounding question, which happens to be another one of those subjects that is not very well covered in the ham radio literature or in the educational courses that electrical engineers take. For the last few weeks, we've been discussing directional couplers. Tonight, we'll be discussing an antenna technique that's not very well covered. The usual very loose schedule is that approximately for the first hour, we take questions and answers, and those questions get somewhat briefly answered. At a much later time in the TechNet, more deeper subjects can and usually do get discussed. That's followed by approximately at 9 o'clock, John goes to the mailbag, where people who don't yet have their ham radio license or don't have the correct equipment to talk to us, but they send John a email, snail mail, pigeon dropping with their question. And if it's a question of general interest, John chooses one, two, three of those. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, who really keeps track of what NASA has been doing for the last 20 years. And by way of the Rosetta spacecraft that landed on Comet 67P, there's usually quite a bit of information like that for Paul to tell us. Okay, at this time I'm going to take in check-in. You check into the TechNet by giving your call letters, your name, the word yes, which means you do not have, that you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in because you're listening. This is TechNet number 1531 of the series that began in September of 1982, 32 years ago. It doesn't have to be proven to us that someone is listening. By now, we sort of understand that. Okay, give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
And to XGN, Wes, and yes, the only, what I do not know is it for the first hour for the after poll? It's about a device that looks like slotted line, sort of directional coupler. I'm joking. You have the pictures of it. And also, it's a tuner. And it's made by Murray Microwave. And to
Very fine, Wes. And Murray Microwave has been in the news lately by way of the microwave reflector, by way of the listserv of the microwave reflector. And so I'll be bringing that to your attention a little bit later. Anyone else to check in who does have a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW.
WX2SJN, TechNet. And this is November 2, Yankee Lima. My name here is Mike, and yes, I have a question.
We got you, Mike. November 2, Yankee Lima. My voice, once again, is coming out of something in this house. Gotta find out what it is. Okay. Is it that? Ah, found it. Found where my voice is coming out. And I found a way of stopping that from happening. Okay. There was somebody who signed in before Mike. Who is the person who signed in before Mike? K2RIW? John, there was a set of call letters before Mike. Did you catch those? KC2WGB, K2IW.
Negative, Dick. It was kind of low, but there definitely was somebody there. A little noisy.
Okay. Let's see. Right now, we have Wes and Mike checked in. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now. If you've got a question or a comment for the net, call it as a name, please. K2RIW listening.
WS2N, Paul with the Space Report. Good evening, everybody.
Very fine, Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call it as a name right now. K2RIW.
KD2FQU Mobile. Name is John, and yes, I have a question.
We got you, John. And, John, would you be within range for a reasonable length of time, or should we make sure we catch you pretty fast?
I'll be in range for a reasonable amount of time, another 40 minutes on the road before I get home. Back to you, Dick. KD2FQ.
Okay, we got you, John. So, Mike, Wes, John, anyone else? Give me a call letters and name if you've got a question or comment for the TechNet tonight.
KD2EXP, the name is Mike, and yes, I do have a question.
Okay, Mike, did I get Kilo Delta 2 X? Echo X-ray Papa, is that true, Mike?
Kilo, David, Echo, sorry about that, Kilo David, 2, Echo X-ray Bravo.
Okay, Echo X-ray Bravo, we got it now. And one last call, anyone else with a question or comment for the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2WGB with a little experiment on directional couplers if we have time, Dick.
Okay, we got you, John. Alrighty. Wes, let's assume now that you do have a specific question that other hams would like to know about on your slotted line coupler tuner. I haven't seen the email. I was out today, so I haven't seen my recent email. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. There is a very strangely looking device. It does have a digital display, but that's the newest addition to my microwave device. It does have two very fine micrometers on the top of it, and one would have think that this is a slotted line. Apparently, it's being called tuner. Now, Well, the good thing about it, it works from 0.8 of gigahertz, which is 800 megahertz, up to 18 gigahertz. It's extremely small and light. So it does have an application, but it is primary application is it is a standard matching wrench device. It's a tuner. It's being called tuner. So because you didn't see that email, it's November 18, which is 5 days ago. Let me drop. November 18. It was sent to you and to John. Maybe we could let it go for now, so the gentleman that is on the road could ask the question, and after that, you would be able, in the meantime, to see the pictures. You have two links. One of them is the link to at least five or six pictures, but if not, then you have directly in the email two pictures of the device. And to explain.
By the way, Glenn knows about that item and has used it, so if he's on, he would be able to explain exactly what it is also. Back to you, Dick.
I'm looking at those pictures right now. Thank goodness he told me it was the 18th. Because I've gotten an awful lot of emails before I knew how far to look back. It has a degree of similarity with the slide tuner, a slide screw tuner called Hewlett-Packard. I'm trying to find the model number. I'm holding on to this slide screw tuner that I own, which is related. Hewlett-Packard calls it the X870A. X870A. That's not the usual way that Hewlett-Packard makes their numbers. Mine happens to be a waveguide version. It's a piece of WR90 waveguide with a micrometer that adjusts the penetration of a probe inside of the waveguide, and the waveguide can, and that probe can be slid earlier and later in the waveguide, and there's another micro dial there which is rated in fractions of millimeters, so that by positioning the probe the proper depth and the proper position, you can correct many pieces of waveguide standing wave ratio. The thing that Wes has a picture of, so if I know Wes, he probably has purchased this thing because he likes collecting exotic things like this. Too bad not more. In fact, maybe this should be put onto the Mike Number 2 website so other people can see a picture of this. I see this beautiful digital display on the front, which I'm guessing the digital display tells you how far you have slid the thing left and right. Let me drop. And this looks like it's a coaxial structure. In other words, it's got a, looks like an SMA connector on the left-hand side. And I don't see a picture of the right-hand side. I'm guessing it's got an SMA connector going in and going out. I'm guessing it is a coaxial slotted line. By adjusting the depth of those two micrometer probes, you're adjusting the amount of perturbation. Now, one of the crazy things of transmission lines is that if you have, let's say, an antenna that's giving you some standing wave ratio, that really means a mismatch. A piece of 50-ohm transmission line, for instance, wants to see nothing as a load but a pure 50-ohm resistor. As long as your antenna looks like a pure 50-ohm resistor, not higher or lower in resistance, and no reactants connected to it, then your transmission line will be perfectly happy. Anything less than that, let me drop. If your antenna is anything different from a 50-ohm resistor, lower or higher numbers of ohms of resistance, or any number of ohms of capacitor reactants or inductive reactants, if any of that other than a 50-ohm resistor is your antenna, then by definition on a piece of 50-ohm transmission line feeding that antenna, not all of the signal will go into the antenna. Some of it will be reflected. That reflected signal, we amateurs usually call it standing wave ratio. The more exotic, the more exacting people using a vector network analyzer call it
voltage reflection characteristic, which has the symbol of S11. S11 means, the number one means that port number one of your device on the test was the input port, and the second one means the port number one was the output port. So you're looking at what goes into port number one and what reflects out of port number one. That's why they call it S11. And so if S11 is anything above zero, zero is desirable in this case, no reflected signal, that would be a one-to-one standing wave ratio. If anything is being reflected, it comes rolling back down the transmission line toward the signal generator or toward the antenna. Let me drop. Now, slide screw tuners. That's what this thing is. It's a slide screw tuner, and this is a more precision one, which has more than one probe and a micrometer dial, which allows you to move it along the line. If you can recognize that, yes, this is a reflected signal, and then by creating a second reflecting signal, by putting a probe near the center conductor of a transmission line, you are creating a capacitive reactance. And if you can shift that capacitive reactance to the right position along the line, and if you can adjust the magnitude of that capacitive reactance, which is what you're doing when you're adjusting the depth of that probe, then in theory you can create the exact same reflected signal that your antenna is creating. And if you do it at the right position, you know, as far as the transmitter is concerned, there's now two signals being reflected back to them. However, if you're smart enough to make those two signals 180 degrees out of phase and equal to each other, then the transmitter will see no reflected signal. The two signals coming back toward it will cancel each other. That's what the slide screw tuner does, this double slide screw tuner. I haven't ever seen one of these, but I can recognize the theory of operation. It's very similar to the X870, I think it is the model number, the one that I've got in my hand, the waveguide equivalent. Yes, X870A by Hewlett-Packard, a very precision impedance-correcting device in both cases. So you've got a beauty there, Wes. And if I know you, you probably got this for much less than the original manufacturer suggested retail price. I'm not sure, but if someone told me that this particular device, brand new, sold for $10,000, I would believe it. And to
repeater, timeout.
Let me make sure that we've got the, we still have the Eastern repeater. Oh, what a delay. I'm amazed how much delay there is to the Eastern repeater tonight. So, as I said, my rough guess is this probably sold brand new for $10,000. And if I know Wes, he probably got it for a little bit less than that. He's very good at finding these bargains. Congratulations. N2XJN, how long have you owned this beautiful thing, K2LIW and the TechNet?
That's interesting, N2XJN. At first, I didn't get it yet. I offered John to have it for $25. But he said he has no use for it. I think he's still contemplating. It was rather for me trying to make John happy. I would love to have it because $25 is not a big deal. The typical price for it is $5,229. The used one usually goes for $3,139. That's the price. Now it's for $25. So before we put it on a Bernie's website, I would rather give a chance to Glenn or John, if they think they may need it, to have it. So I would love to have it, but I'm not that hungry for it yet. My question to you is, what is the power level that this thing could handle? And to actually...
Okay. If Glenn is not interested and John is not interested, I'm interested. That's something I could use, because it does a precision job of correcting standing wave ratio. Now, this method of standing waiver is your correction, whether you do it with a waveguide, with a probe going into it, or you do it with this coaxial cable. They are somewhat power limited, because above some particular power, the method by which you're creating the perturbation to the line, which you're trying to set it to be equal in magnitude to the real reflection of the antenna, and 180 degrees out of phase, you choose 180 degrees out of phase by sliding this thing upline or downline, so to speak, closer to the transmitter or further from the transmitter, and you eventually receive the get to the point where the second signal you're creating with that probe is 180 degrees out of phase. In my case, in my guess, Wes, this thing is power limited by the connector. My impression is that it is a SMA, 3-millimeter connector on the left-hand side, and that's the real power limitation. A 3-millimeter connector, at low frequencies, very rarely will anybody go beyond 50 watts with one of those. There was a condition on the B-1 bomber, on the so-called tail warning radar system, where there was an SMA connector, and they were pushing it to something like 70 watts, and they were getting less than 100% reliability out of it. So an SMA connector, I think rarely should a person go beyond 50 watts. And so this technique of impedance correcting, I think, can tolerate 50 watts. If you go much beyond that, there's a slim chance you'll arc over the probe, or there's a slim chance that you'll develop a failure in the SMA connector. So,
repeater, timeout.
I'm real good at timing out the repeater tonight. And I see that the eastern repeater is off the air, so I'm going to let the machine thoroughly drop so that there's a chance we'll reset the 147.375 repeater. K2IW standing by. We'll be back. Yeah, it looks like we've got some real good propagation going on tonight. It is my guess that we're hearing the Torrington repeater in Connecticut, which has a so-called squelch tail failure. In other words, the repeater wants to turn itself off. As it does, a burst of noise comes along and reinitiates that repeater. So you're hearing these continuous bursts of noise coming from that northern repeater. Let's see now if the... Huge amount of delay, but at least we do have the eastern repeater working. So, John, have you seen this picture and the explanation I've given so far? Does it make a little bit of a mental picture as to how it works? When it comes to small amounts of standing wave ratio correction with very low insertion loss, the two techniques that have been used in the past are a so-called slide screw tuner, which is what this is, or a slug tuner. The slug tuner really is a piece of dielectric material that's inside of a coaxial structure, and it looks like a slotted line because you can slide it up, down, up range, and down range. And in fact, there's two slugs, and depending on the separation you put between those two capacitive slugs that are done with a dielectric material, the spacing between the two and the spacing along the line allows you to do small amounts of Biswas correction. The slug tuner, I think, is rarely used beyond 1.5 or 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And this slide screw tuner probably also is not recommended to go beyond about 1.5 or 2.0. But when it comes to the theory of operation, I wonder if you've got a mental picture on this one, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, and I've seen the picture of it. But I believe the application is you use it until you determine what you need with those measurements, and then you build the structure to correct the difficulty. You don't actually use that to operate it. You know, you can do that at low power, like 5 watts, 10 watts, make your device, and then run it at whatever power you need. I believe that's the application.
Yeah, I heard somebody also make a comment about the repeater being restored or some of the comment. Before I address what John just said, was there another person who made a comment? Please repeat your statement. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Okay, I heard a weak carrier, but no audio at that time. The way the person usually uses this, John, you're assuming that the person has made a precision measurement on a antenna analyzer or a vector network analyzer, knows what the amplitude and phase of the reflection is, and then wants to use this tool. That's one way. And you could do it in that manner, in other words, in a very precise, calculated manner. The way most people use a slide screw tuner or a double slug tuner is to set up their equipment back at the transmitter looking at reflected power. In other words, it's a kind of standing wave ratio detector where you've already done the forward peaking of the needle, and you go to the reverse mode, and you're looking at reflected power. While looking at reflected power, you adjust the probe up and down on this micrometer dial, and you slide this thing along the length until the reflected power that you sense on your standing wave ratio indicator or directional coupler disappears. That's the way these things are usually used. So you've got a beauty there, Wes. Very nicely made piece of equipment. And I think you did say it's Hewlett-Packard, and almost everything they make looks like it's nearly gold-plated, if you know what I mean. N2XJN, it's a beauty. K2LIW in the TechNet.
You said Murray Microwave.
Okay, another really good company. Murray Microwave is most famous for making a precision set of calibration devices. In other words, you buy one of their set of calibrators for your vector network analyzer. You get at least three things in the package, and you pay big bucks for them. One of them is a 50-ohm resistor, which usually is rated at 50 ohms from 0 to 18 gigahertz, or 0 to 18 gigahertz, and it's so close to 50 ohms that it itself has a reflection of more than 30 dB down, if you know what I mean. So they make a real good precision, very broadband 50-ohm termination, which is called the load. They also make a precision short circuit and a precision open circuit. And you can buy those Murray calibration kits for almost any set of connectors that your instrumentation uses. Let me drop. That could be SMA, 3 millimeter, 2.4 millimeter, type N, the 7 millimeter and 3.5 millimeter precision connectors. I can't think of the model numbers on those.
APC.
That's the one. AP7, APC3, I think they're called. And so any of those connectors are the method by which you order the Murray Microwave a calibration kit. There was a report on the microwave reflector this week. Let me drop. Where a person had a particular piece of instrumentation which is used for noise figure calibration, and he needed a part inside that's no longer manufactured. It's not a supported piece of instrumentation. But by some means, he found out that Murray Microwave was selling one in used condition, and so he bought the one from Murray Microwave. When it arrived, he realized that it had been gutted, as they say, certain components had been removed. He went back to Murray Microwave complaining that he received less than what was advertised, and they gave him some pretty derogatory answers. So he was making a guess that Murray Microwave is not doing very well right now because of that particular response. This particular man on the microwave reflector run by WA1MBA, that's the response that he got. So it's possible that I'm not quite sure what happened. So that's under normal circumstances in the past, when you bought a calibration kit from Hewlett-Packard for your Hewlett-Packard vector network analyzer, the calibration kit was really remarked product made by Murray Microwave. And whether or not Murray is still supplying those kits for Hewlett-Packard is not known to me right now. N2XJN, K2LIW, what do you intend to do next with this one, Wes?
And to exchange, that email was sent only to John and to you, As far as I know, John doesn't see the application, and Glenn does not as well. But I would appreciate if Glenn could say a few words about it. So you have the first link above the pictures. You just click on it, right-click on it, and open up in the new window. That's where it takes you. The price is $25. It's going to grow a little bit, but not much. As you see, the description is completely wrong, which helps. And you're going to have it. But you have to, if you have a question about how this goes, then John would be able to help you out, or I would be able to help you out, but not on the repeater. Interesting is that there was about 7 months ago when I had another item like that. It was wrongly described, so it was hard to even find it. And I spoke about it on the radio with John, and I got a competition because I said how much that was worth, and it was a few $100,000. It was for $25. The price went over $5,000, then I gave up. So, interesting is that with the people is, if you don't tell them, listen, this is very valuable, they're not interested. So, if you wanna get it, you can get it by yourself. Enter it in.
Yeah, it sounds like this maybe is an eBay. I'm not sure. If no one else is interested, that price is too good, if you know what I mean. And maybe by the words I've said, I've now increased the price. I did write an article in QST Magazine, I think it was February of 1977, somewhere around there. It was the article on the subject of outdoor range improvement techniques by way of ratiometry. And in the article, I used the Hewlett-Packard 416. Hewlett-Packard 416 was a fairly ancient standing wave ratio measuring equipment, popular way back in 1980 or so. They were typically selling on the surplus market for numbers like $25 and $40 because of that article of mine, of this ancient piece of equipment that I used. All of a sudden, a lot of ham radio operators needed one of those, and the price jumped up to much higher prices for anybody who had one in their basement, if you know what I mean. So I did create a run on an ancient piece of equipment once by writing an article. And so for numbers like what we're talking about, let me drop. I'm interested in buying this, so you'd be doing me a favor if it is a something that you can bid on. And you do so in a reasonable length of time, I'd be willing to pay at least $100 for this thing. Not because I absolutely need it. It's because it is a little bit on the unique side. And there are certain kind of things, unique things in the microwave world, in the VHF, UHF microwave world, that I collect, and this might very well be one of them. So give that some thought. And yes, I've been looking at the website now, the email. And I thank you for sending that to me. We're going to go over to the next person, which was Mike. November 2, Yankee Lemur, K2LAW. Go right ahead, Mike. WHYYY. Okay, RYY, you're on the list. And I did have a Mike into Yankee Lemur, if I... November 2, and maybe he's not here now.
Don't forget yet, 40 minutes, it's about that time.
I have to do something in 40 minutes, it's about that time. I'll repeat that, John.
We have John waiting in the vehicle. He's mobile, and you told him, you know, he said he had about 40 minutes, and we're about 35 minutes into it now.
You're right. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Quebec Yankee, mobile. K2RIW, go right ahead, John.
Thank you very much, Dick. I apologize. It's KD2FQU, uniform, mobile. My question was for the 5 gigahertz. I apologize. Let me step down for a moment. Let me just pull over for a moment. Hold on, please. Go back in SecNet. My question was the it wasn't approached last week, but this week I thought we might have time. Pretty quick, just the FCC's ruling on the 5 gigahertz spectrum, and my question was the conflict between routers operating on the 5 gigahertz and the amateur radio spectrum that we can work within on the 5 gigahertz range.
Yeah, I think I know what you're asking. What the FCC has been doing lately, particularly on the 802.11 A, I think it's called, frequency range, or B, in other words, the 2.4 gigahertz region, we amateurs essentially share that assignment with all of those zillions of modern-day spread spectrum type of remote control equipment for model aircraft. They're on 2.4 gigahertz. There's a whole lot of cordless telephone-like things that are also using spread spectrum. And the net result is that almost anybody who sets up something like a reliable link, you might be trying to do a linking of two repeaters, for instance, and you set it up on 2.4 gigs, from time to time you will experience some interference. Now, just this very week, it's a good thing we didn't answer this question last week, John, just this very week, somebody who has been using a vital microwave link that is maintaining a security system for a local municipality, that security system is running on the 5 gigahertz band in a spread spectrum manner, and that person is now looking for methods of getting off of 5 gigs to go to some other frequency region, because no matter where he chooses 5 gigahertz to operate his vital equipment, from time to time he's experiencing an intolerable amount of interference. Part of what goes on, let me drop this, is that on paper, the FCC believes as long as everybody who is sharing the frequency assignment is doing it in a spread spectrum manner, and one of the methods of getting spread spectrum is so-called frequency hopping. In other words, over across a certain frequency region, in the case of the license-free band, for instance, on 902 to 928 megacycles, you could run a 1-watt license-free transmitter. As long as every few milliseconds you hop to another frequency, they choose 50 separate frequencies between 902 and 928. I think they're like either 20 or 50 kc separated. And if you're using a pseudo-random code to hop from frequency A to frequency B to C to D and so on, then you're allowed to run 1 watt license-free. And the whole philosophy there is that if you're running, say, for instance, a low-power cordless phone on one of those frequencies, and your cordless phone happens not to be a frequency hopper, it's just sitting on one frequency, the chances of that that transmitter spending any significant period of time on your favorite frequency, being close enough to give you grief, might happen for a fraction of one syllable, of one word, once every couple of minutes, so to speak. And so from that point of view, it's tolerable. Well, it's tolerable up to a point. If you're doing this in downtown New York City, when you might have a large number of people running a similar service, then a very small amount of interference you and I might experience from a couple of other users at that frequency by the spread spectrum technique. As that number of people goes to very high numbers, then all of a sudden the interference starts becoming intolerable. And you might also have the so-called near-far problem. Let me drop. In other words, you can tolerate a transmitter that's not on your frequency, that's frequency hopping, if it's at some reasonable range. If it happens to be a high-power, license-free transmitter frequency hopping, and it's your next-door neighbor, course, let you. You're not going to be happy with that service. So I am guessing that the 5 gig band is starting to run into that high use interference problem, obvious by what this person brought to my attention recently. Therefore, I would do a little bit more checking. In other words, by way of going to the Tom Williams website, wa1mba.org, and then maybe signing into his list of people who are using the microwave reflector. The microwave reflector is a group of people on this listserv where of the roughly 1,000 people who are very serious in microwave ham radio experimentation, they all get to know each other on a first-name basis. And so there's probably about 5 emails per day that they all get where each one is talking to the whole group, so to speak, saying, I need a so-and-so part. Does anybody have one for my 5-gig transmitter, if you know what I mean? So by way of Tom Williams, WA1MBA, his website, and that listserv, you should be able to get a lot more information about the current grief of the people who are using 5 gigs right now. And before I make a big investment in equipment there, I'd probably want to check into that one. Maybe that'll be helpful to you, John. KC2, Foxtrot Quebec, Uniform, Mobile, K2IW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. K2IW, KD2SQU on the subnet. Appreciate that information. I will take a look into it when I get a chance at a computer later on today. That actually satisfied my answer. Thank you very much, and back to TechNet, KD2FQU.
Yeah, I believe you said you pulled over in order to make that previous transmission very wise, because when it comes to concentrated information that we sort of send back and forth to each other on this TechNet, for you to be involved in one of those conversations while doing complicated driving on, say, for instance, the Long Island Expressway, would definitely create a problem of diverted attention, even though you may be running hands-free. You're a hell of a lot safer to go over to one side to make that conversation. And because of that beautiful subject you asked us last week, that's to last quite a while, we didn't get to the 5 gigs. There's a slight advantage of you waiting this week, because I heard this additional information of a person who has been using 5 gigs, let me call it commercially, for approximately 5 years, and in the last few months, the popularity of that kind of equipment has increased so substantially that he's now getting a degree of interference he cannot tolerate on this high-priority service of a of monitoring equipment. This happens to be a television monitoring equipment that is being maintained in order to create security at a particular site. Let me drop. And in that particular situation, he cannot tolerate any dropouts in the particular service. He's experiencing those dropouts at 5 gigs now, and he's in the process of switching to another frequency region in order to get around the problem. Now, maybe it's just something that happened locally in the Suffolk County, in the western Suffolk County area. I'm not sure. However, if it's happening in western Suffolk County, where this person I know of is running into the difficulty, as you go into the more densely populated areas of Nassau, Queens, and Brooklyn, and toward the five boroughs of New York City, I wouldn't believe that the problem is going to get lighter. It would have to get heavier because there's more and more people there using it, is my guess. So it's something to consider, John. Good question. The next person who signed in was another mic, Kilo Delta 2, X-ray. Here we go. Echo, X-ray, Bravo. Go right ahead, Mike. K2IW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Mike got called away. That's mic number 2, and mic number 1 was November 2, Yankee, Yankee, Lima. Are either one of the mics available? K2IW.
With a quick comment on the 5.8 gigahertz.
Dick, over.
Okay, I heard Bill, QGZ, who's going to give us some information about 5 gigs. Then I heard somebody said, Dick, over. Who said Dick, over?
Yeah,
Yeah, this is November 2, Yankee Yankee Lima. How do you hear me? Over.
Now we're hearing you quite well, Mike. 5% noise, 95% audio. You sound pretty good, and your audio is a little bit low. But the previous question, we've got some additional information from Bill, WB2QGZ. QGZ, give us your information on 5 gigs, Bill. I wonder if you're starting to experience spread spectrum interference that's becoming quite strong. You've got it, Bill. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2QGZ, good evening. So, I abandoned 5.8 probably somewhere between 2 and 3 years ago. And I have what you could consider a somewhat critical need for uptime and continuity. So, I mean, I was on as a tenant in a wideband 5.8 path that shot north and south down to the barrier island from Babylon. And that was the last one I think we abandoned just because of interference, and it was unusable. It was probably impacted for some number of hours per month, which is, you know, pretty crappy reliability. You know, the bad news is, you know, actually I think I know who you're talking about. You know, you maintain you have a critical need for some sort of municipality or something. Unfortunately, you have to do pretty much what my place did, which is get licensed paths. So I replaced all of that junk with 21 and 23 gigahertz duplex wideband paths from various places along the south shore down to Barrier Island. And that's, I mean, that's the fix for it. That band, the 5.8, is kind of like ISM. If it, you know, if it works, you're good. If it doesn't work, you got to eat whatever interference you get. And it's honestly not necessarily prudent to put something critical in that band to begin with. Back to net.
Thank you, Bill. Very good information. So you're giving confirmation to what I heard this week. Yes, you're making a guess as to who it is that you and I both know who's running into this grief, and he's switching off of that frequency region because of that, and you've already run into that 2 years ago. Oh, amazing. Okay, so there is a correlation there. And I'm trying to remember now. Is it 5763, the main ham radio calling frequency on 5 gigs? Let's see, all the 5 gig ham radio frequencies happen to be related to a specific harmonic of 144. And so 5763, oh, wait a minute now. I may be confusing that with a popular vacuum tube. What's the frequency that ham radios usually use as a calling frequency on the 5 gigs band, if you happen to know, Bill? Mr. QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. By the way, you sound good tonight. Sounds like you're on a good base station.
Yeah, I got my big microphone. So, I don't recall. You know, 5796 stuck in my brain. I know it's got a 5 in it, I'll put it that way. I don't remember offhand. And the other thing real quick with that other stuff, I mean, that's the difference in cost. I mean, you can get a 5 gig path mass produced, you know, from one of these places that makes halfway decent stuff for $200, $300, $400. All of these 21, 23 gigahertz license paths, in addition to needing, you know, something to hang it on that's pretty high, by the time you're done with these things, they're probably in the vicinity of 30. So, big, big difference. Back to that.
Very fine, Bill. I thank you for that information. And Mike, sorry we created this delay, but we had to give that additional information from the previous subject. So, fire away with your question, Mike. You sound good. And give us a little bit more audio if you could. November 2, Yankee Yankee Lima, K2RAW. You got it, Mike.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Dick. Good evening, everyone on the net. My question has to do more with HD TVs. I know about 720 and I know about 1080p and all that stuff, but recently I just heard about 4K. I was wondering if anybody has some information on 4K. I'm sure it's a higher resolution. And I see some TVs out there that are being sold at Best Buy, for example. I was just wondering if broadcasters are broadcasting that 4K signal. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I want to know about this one also, Mike. And the expert on this one would be Eric, KE2EJ, who is the chief engineer for Channel 13 in New York City and Channel 21 out here in Long Island. And he keeps his ear very close to the ground on, when it comes to broadcast equipment and whether or not 4K is now being broadcast over the air, 4,000 lines, so to speak, as opposed to the 1080 Progressive or the 720. Eric is the man you and I want to talk to. I'm approaching the point where I've got to go out and buy a real television set. I'm still using a set-top converter, Radio Shack brand name, into my old-fashioned analog television. So I'm kind of a dinosaur. I'm two or three years downrange of where I should be. I'm about to buy a real digital television. So whatever answer you're going to get on this one, I need it also. I hope Eric is available. I haven't heard him tonight, so I'm a little bit worried. KE2EJ, if you're there, or K2LAW in the TechNet. Okay, Eric is the first guy I would think of on this one. Anyone else who has any information, experience, rumor or whatever, on the subject of high-definition television and whether or not 4K, 4,000-line type television, is or is about to be used for over-the-air broadcast, or maybe even cable TV or microwave link, you know, satellite television. If anybody has any information on 4K, give us your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
4 Alpha Oscar.
K82FQU with comments.
Okay, I heard a slightly distorted Alpha Alpha something, as well as John, FQU, I think it was. The Alpha Alpha or something like that first. Give me your full set of call letters and your name, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Kilo Mike 4, Alpha Oscar Oscar. The name's Richard. Over.
Okay, Alpha Oscar Oscar. Go right ahead, Richard, and tell us what you know about 4K digital television. You've got it, Oscar, Alpha Oscar Oscar.
KM4AOO. I do know they are starting to test it out around my area, and what I've noticed, it's on cable TV, by the way, is that when you look at the picture on a standard analog television, for example, and you, cathode ray tube, you can tell if you look in the background, say it's a picture of the ocean, you can tell that it's more higher resolution and the things in the background move faster. Now, the TV I have in my living room, which is 1080p, which can also handle what you guys are talking about too, I've tested it with that. You can actually see from my perspective, especially if you use an HDMI cable, the more sharpness and clearness, but it also depends on your TV and plasma versus flat screen. I have a flat screen, but I do know that it does, at least down here, produce a sharper and somewhat of a little brighter image from what I've noticed.
Very fine. Let's see if I've got the right guy. Kilo Mike 4, Alpha Oscar Oscar, a man named Richard in Tennessee. Do I have the right person? Over to you, sir.
Review with comment.
Yeah, Roger, you have the right person. You may remember me as Kilo Juliet 4 India Lima Kilo. That used to be my prior call. Over.
Very fine. I'm looking at his QRZ.com website, and he shows some of his ham radio equipment. Oh, he's got a nice picture here of what propagation between two mountains would be like with the Fresnel zones. One of his pictures is a him on horseback. There's a local ham radio operator on Long Island who has the suffix of Hotel Mike Mike, and he also is a horse person, and he calls himself Horse-Mounted Mobile. You could also say those words, Richard. Very good, and I thank you for the information. Now, who's the other person who had some information for us? Give me your call letters again. I'm a little bit slow tonight. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, that I think is John, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform Mobile. Go right ahead, John.
Thank you very much, Dick. KD2XQU. To comment about the HD use on newer televisions, I used to be a subcontractor and an internal technician for Dish Network a couple years ago, and it's really up to the provider. I'm not sure so likely. I work with Cablevision, not so likely. I've seen that they've started broadcasting any new, of course, their HD channels in something that would be familiar of 1080p. In order for 1080p or even higher to show on a screen, you would need like either broadband or that ultra HD TV setup. I know Dish Network and DirecTV, some of their footage is 1080p, is given a high-speed internet connection, of course. But that's just my comment. KD2FQU.
John, if I'm going to make a guess now. If I was a cable TV subscriber, which I'm not, I'm one of the last people that still does purely over-the-air broadcast. And if you drive around the community of Dix Hills, Long Island, the section of Huntington, and the Dix Hills section has got 26,000 people, there is one single house that has, to my knowledge, a on-the-roof aerial for television reception that's still being used. That plus the antenna on my tower allows me to get very good television reception. So I think you're saying that there is a service that might be available. I'm guessing it's a premium service where you have to pay some extra dollars for it to get this ultra-high-definition television. Is that approximately true, John? KD2FQU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KTRIW, KD2FQ. No, not at all. It's Samsung just started pushing a new television that has Ultra HD. Apologize, I forgot the gentleman's call sign. His comment was just for how the screen would show. Even with an aerial, one of those old fancy antennas that we still have on some roofs, I doubt that the providers are broadcasting in that. It took them a very long time in order to upgrade to the HD service, and I think Obama delayed it about another year until everybody was able to change their services up to HD broadcast and completely nullify the analog signal. But from what I've known in the installer side, is that the device, let me let it drop for a moment. The device, which is the receiver, either it be your television that has it built in, HD tuner, or your own set-top box, like a cable box or a satellite box, it has to be on the provider that's broadcasting in that service. For Dish Network, their 1080p or above service was available through internet connection for on-demand. I believe the same thing goes for Cablevision. I have Cablevision at my location. I just have a 1080i that's box broadcast. I can... HD streaming from Xbox 360 or a Blu-ray player that supports HD service and one of those paid services. So it really depends on what is providing that information to the television in order to get that picture quality. KD2FQ, you're back to TechNet.
Thank you, John. Anyone else who has any information about the highest definition, the highest resolution type of digital television? Any further information? If you've got it, give me a call with us right now. K2RI, W in the TechNet.
Alpha 2 Alpha Victor Uniform with a question.
Okay, Alpha Victor Uniform. As long as it's...
Sir Oscar with a question.
Okay, I heard Alpha Victor Uniform and Alpha Oscar in that order. Alpha Victor Uniform, you said you had a question. As long as it's on this particular subject line,